Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Social Work Radio with me, your host Vince Peart. Once again, we are joined by our co-host Cara Davis. Cara, my friend, how the devil are you? How have things been since you were last aboard the good ship SWR?
They've been brilliant, actually. I've been very much embracing my self-care world this week, following on from my beach saunas the week before.
Nice. I'm
fully embracing it. I had a little massage today.
You massage yourself? Or do you massage your lymphs? Or did someone else do it for you?
No, massaging of my lymphs. A proper massage.
You weren't slapping your lymphs today.
I wasn't slapping my lymphs. I haven't gone that far down the dark hole of Instagram reels. No, I went for like a proper massage because obviously it's 4 years since started working from home. And it's just now that I've started to realise that perhaps my setup of crouching over my laptop for 4 years hasn't been very good for my back. So I've invested in a little massage and also an adapter so that I can do a standing desk situ.
Right. You had my curiosity. Now you've got my interest. I am a standing desk fan. I have pined after one for a while. I bought one this time last year when I moved into my new house. And then I didn't take it out of the box because I got rid of it because it didn't fit in my office room. And I was like, it's not really going to fit because the layout just wouldn't work for a standing desk. But I'm back on it. Our editor here at Social Work News, I was at her house a couple of weeks back, stayed overnight because I was working in the area. We did a little bit of work. We were delivering some training for some educational psychologists who we work for a company that also employs educational psychologists too. So anyway, when I was at her, she had a walking pad. It's essentially a treadmill, but without the handles. It goes at a walking pace rather than running pace. Mm-hmm. And I was like, says Nick, I've been keen on getting one of these because I wanted to pair it with a standing desk whilst I'm sat at home writing up reports. I can walk at the same time. Very good for your exercise, keeps you active, because there's loads and loads of evidence which shows a sedentary lifestyle is terribly bad for your health.
Yeah.
And I had a go and it was brilliant. And I was like, yes, I'm going to do this. So I've got the walking pad and I've also bought a standing desk as well. I'm not going to have it in my office room. I'm going to set it up in the corner of the front room. So I am going to hopefully get mine set up this weekend. So I will let you know how it goes.
Oh, do, because I haven't invested full whack yet because I'm not certain. It's like one of those things, you know, like you buy, it's like the big Pilates ball, isn't it? You sit on and you're like, right, this is the new me. And then it gets like deflated in the corner for like 3 years. So I haven't gone full hog yet. So I'm interested to know whether or not you enjoy it and it works for you. But yeah, I thought I'd get a little adapter, try this standing up malarkey. Like you say, sitting down for 8 hours a day probably isn't very good for me. Well, it isn't, because I'm in bits. Isn't. My back is so sore. So yeah, that's my self-care treat to myself this week.
Well, I shall let you know. So the list of videos I've got to send you. I've still got to send you one of me doing my lymph slapping. And this is an extender. It goes up and down. So it's like a normal desk. You press a button and it goes up. My kids are going to love it. I imagine they're going to be playing with it in the majority of the time. Talking about self-care, I've taken a leaf out of your book. We talked about walking. I committed to walking 10,000 steps a day. I've done it for 8 days in a row now. Eight days in a row.
Wow.
And I honestly, I feel really, really good for it. I feel really, really good. For it. I mean, I always like to get out for a walk in the morning. I usually get out for a walk in an afternoon. Mm. I've never really said to myself, right, I'm definitely going to do 10,000. But it's one of those things where once you do it, you realize how easy it is. You know, I get up, I'll do like a 40-minute walk first thing. I always convinced myself that I was too busy to take time out for myself during the day. But when you find that time, my productivity levels haven't dropped. If anything, I'm doing a bit better because I feel a bit more active and healthy and I'm working quicker. So it just goes to show the importance of kind of carving that time out for yourself, doesn't it? Because I'm doing that, maybe walking for an hour and a half a day now, and I feel loads better for it. So thank you for the inspiration.
No, I'm glad you're enjoying it. I always plan to go out for a lunchtime walk, but it never happens. Mm. But I feel like a morning walk always fits in really well. So yeah, little 10k, so good. 10k is actually, it's good, it's easy to do, but it's also not easy to do, is it? It's an hour and a half a day is quite a long time. But yeah, I'm glad you're into it and you give me a bit of motivation to crack on with a few more steps.
Works out well, but I have got a dilemma. I think I've got an addiction. Yeah, I think I've got an addiction. Honestly, I think I'm addicted to mango.
Oh, from our conversation before about mango, was that pineapple? Is it just fruit?
Pineapple.
Just fruit in
Yeah.
general,
Well,
tropical fruit?
obviously I've, oh no, do you know what? I feel like I've just lost the game there because
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about, I'd kind of forgotten about how upset I was about having to hand that pineapple over to the lady at the traffic lights, but you've reminded, thanks mate.
Right,
Cheers.
sorry.
Thank you for that.
Mango.
You've reminded me of my PTSD, pineapple traumatic.
It's just the highlight of your week every week is some sort of tropical fruit that you bought from
This is what I've got going on. This is
Aldi.
what. I'm currently eating 2 packets of mango a day, and I think I crave it. So today I was coming back from an assessment session, was just planning on getting back, typing up my notes and getting ready for tonight's podcast. And I had to drive about 10 mile out of my way just to go and get some mango. And I had this mania that. It was like when I used to smoke cigarettes many years ago. I just, all I could think was mango, mango, mango. I just had to get mango, and I think I've developed a mango dependency.
Well, I mean, it's full of fiber, so I'm sure that it's good for you. But do you think you're like your personality now you've taken all the things that you used to do that were maybe were not always the most positive behaviors,
That's
and
the
then you've
safe.
just
That's
like
the safest thing we could probably say on a podcast. Yes, that's probably about the
and then
safest thing we could say on a podcast.
you
Yes.
funneled it into tropical fruits, and like mad, like lymph flapping sort of like situations. Like you've just like taken the behavior and sort of shifted it into sort of like weird alternatives.
Yeah. The word is sublimation. That's the word you're looking for. It's a psychological phenomena, which is basically we take the desires that we want, which are maladaptive and not societally acceptable, and we sublimate them. I've sublimated my desires and perhaps my need for vices into standing desks, walking paths, 10,000 steps a day, lymph slapping, and mango eating.
So relatable, such a relatable
This is what happens when you turn 40.
Yeah.
This is what happens
Is
when
this
this
your
is just what
midlife?
we
Is this
do.
what we're listening to your midlife in like real time?
I mean, it could be worse. Could be
It
worse.
could be worse.
I could be on the dating websites and down the casino all the time. Like,
Actually, terrible sports car.
terrible sports
Yeah.
guy.
Yeah, no, this is fine. I mean, it's where I think when we have to start reeling you in about certain things, but I feel like at the moment we're fine. Mango is a safe bet, great vi for vitamin A. You know, at least you'll have lovely hair, you know, skin's great,
Paul,
walking.
pull me up when you hear about me booking in a one-way trip to Turkey to get my teeth and hair done. I think that's when, or you hear about me taking testosterone tablets. I think I've got a bit too
You've
far
gone
down the
too
alpha
far.
male podcast route when it gets to that point. I haven't
Gone
cold
too
plunged
far.
yet. I haven't
You
got an
haven't cold
ice
plunged.
bath
See,
yet.
I'm cold plunging for you. So maybe between us, we are just the podcast bro between us.
I'll eat the mango, you do the cold plunge. I think I've got a better deal there. I have got the better deal. Right, let's move on, guys. This week's podcast is titled Cats, Dogs and Social Workers. It comes off the back of a supervision column that I wrote on Friday. So every Friday, guys, long-term listeners and long-term readers over at mysocialworknews.com will be aware that I offer social work supervision. So basically, people write in with problems, complaints, queries, dilemmas, and I do my best at answering them. This week's came from a reader who said, "I am wondering what you all think about social workers making home visits and insisting that the family lock up their dogs and cats before they will come in. In my experience, most families consider their pets part of the family, and if you interact with their animals positively, they feel more engaged with you as their worker. In addition, animal abuse can be an indicator of potential child abuse, so I will informally assess that as well. However, I have several co-workers who dislike animals and won't deal with that aspect. Obviously, there are occasional aggressive or overprotective animals, but I've never not had a family at least put the animal in a different room. I will admit that I've had to do paperwork sitting on the family couch with an animal in my lap. The Great Dane actually put his head on my lap, so I just put my clipboard on his head and he was fine. It does help that I love animals, but I've heard some co-workers demand that clients put their animals away. So I'm not going to read out my response, but if you guys want to head over to mysocialworknews.com, you can see my response. So I thought, let's talk about this. Let's talk about this, Cara, because last summer I got in a little bit of trouble. Surprise, surprise, Cara, I got in trouble for saying something a bit controversial. Can you believe it?
No, cannot
No,
believe
never. Me? What? Me? No.
it.
Me running off my mouth and not thinking about things? No. I
Unheard
don't
of.
recognize that man. That isn't the mango man. Anyway, last July, we had a similar question come in, which basically said that they didn't like dogs and they thought it was quite rude that clients had them in. So I replied to that, and my reply was basically, I think you're coming across as quite rude. I was like, oh yeah. Surprisingly, I got a little bit of a backlash. Most people I'd say was kind of on my side, but yeah, I regret calling that social worker rude. It was rude to call her rude. Anyway, off the back of those two things, well, I kind of approached the topic in two different ways, really. I wanted to run this past you. So, let's start with this one. How do you feel about working with pets? Obviously, you probably don't go into people's homes much anymore, but you've spent a lot of your time going in and out of people's homes. How have you found working with family pets when you've been going about your duties as a social worker?
Yeah, I mean, I like pets. I didn't grow up with dogs, so I kind of understand like that sort of nervy feeling around dogs because although I like dogs now, it's not something that I grew up around or like feel like super. Some people are just so comfortable with dogs, aren't they? But I think cats and dogs and pets, they are a great distraction, often when you're going on visits. Like, and I, you know, stroking a dog while you're chatting about something, it's just a great little distraction and, you know, a therapy dog for us sometimes. But I find it difficult to understand the expectations when going into someone else's house that they would adapt the home completely for me. However, I can understand that if you're nervy around dogs or when you're in situations where maybe, and normally it is a dog, isn't it, when we're talking about sort of aggressive animals, that you may want to ask them, you know, is it okay to put them away? But I think pets, cats, I mean, I've worked in residential and fostering. I think animals are such a amazing vessel for empathy and that sort of kindness, calmness. Yeah, I like pets. I don't really see an issue with them, if I'm honest.
So for me, my approach when I'm working with families is ultimately it's their home and I am the guest. Even to this day, I've been a social worker 11 years now. Even to this day, there is a great sense of awkwardness when I have to ask a family to show me around their home when I'm doing a home conditions assessment. Obviously, the nature of my job is very different now. I'm not doing that on a, monthly or fortnightly basis as I would do when I was working frontline child protection. When you go into management and more independent and contract work, obviously your role changes somewhat from that frontline practice that you used to. Obviously, you've gone through a similar shift in your own practice, Carrie. You'll have seen that too. It's still the awkwardness never leaves me. I always feel that intrinsic awkwardness and that belief that I am a guest in their home. I'll always go into a family and I'll say, well, where do you want me to sit? Am I okay to sit here? I'll always accept a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or water. I'll never say no to that. I always feel it's my job as a guest in somebody's home, even though I'm a professional guest, I'm there for a purpose. I always believe it's my job to adapt myself as much as I can to those surroundings. Like you, I don't really have an issue with dogs. My mum's had dogs. I grew up around dogs and cats. Got five cats, so I'm quite used to that kind of environment, being around pets. But for me, it's just an extension. It's an extension of being responsive and being adaptable to your client's home and remembering that you are there. Now, of course, if you've got an aversion to dogs, if you've got some sort of fear, if you genuinely have a phobia, that's very different. I think you can ask people, and I think you can be honest with clients in that position. I've always found that if you're honest with clients, not going to be, oh, well, in that case, I'm going to set the dog on you. No, of course not. But I just think if at all possible, we should always be adaptable. We can't expect the red carpet to be rolled out for us. the vast majority of times in social work, especially in child protection fields, it is an involuntary service. Most people, initially at least, do not want us in their lives. We are there because there's a problem, and most people don't want those problems. And a lot of the time we sense problems where the people we are working with simply do not. We have different thresholds of understanding what's normal and what should be assessed and what should be intervened with and what shouldn't. So for me, I feel absolutely fine working with pets. But saying that, Cara, have you had any difficult experience with pets? Have you had any, to pardon the pun, have you had any hairy experiences with any pets in your time as a social worker?
Yeah, I mean, one stands out to me. I was working with a young person who was going missing a lot and returning to his father's home. And I visited the home with a probation officer. And as we were sort of organising our visit, she's also like, FYI, the dog in one of the dogs in the home has just been through the courts for a public protection situation for biting a stranger's finger, like top of their finger off.
Okay.
So she was like, so we're gonna ask them to muzzle the dog before we go in. And I was like, okay, fine. So she did that, and you know, as a probation officer, much much better at putting in boundaries than I am. And he was sort of, no, I'm gonna put the dog out in the garden, don't worry, I'm gonna put the dog out in the garden. So he went off and put the dog out in the garden. We came in and we went and sat in, and this dog was humongous and was throwing itself at the patio windows, like trying to get in, like barking and like so aggressive. Like it was, I thought, well, any moment, you know, you think the dog's gonna leap through the glass.
Glass is gonna go, yeah. It's gonna be like a Jurassic Park moment. I mean, he's just gonna come in.
Yeah. It was such a chaotic visit, and I think the dog was part of that chaos, you know. When we went in, it was quite clear that there had been drinking happening. There was an unknown male in there that had been drinking. So very quickly, me and the probation officer were sort of like, oh, we've walked into a situation here and we need to get out. But it was, yeah, it was just one of those moments where you think your heart's going in your head and it's in your stomach. Your stomach's in your mouth. I can't think of a word. Then I'm going back. I'm having flashbacks to that moment because it was just so bizarre and so awful. And this dog was so aggressive. And it was just sort of, what do we do if that door opens or that door fails? But yeah, it was insane. And we left not long after. And it was just it. But the dog was reflective of the situation. So most of the time, that situation, you would never be in that situation, you know. That is such a rare, and it's rare because I remember it so vividly, and it probably happened like 6-7 years ago. But yeah, it was pretty terrifying watching this absolutely huge muscly dog throw itself at you.
Wow. So, to be very clear, your fingers were all intact, none of those were bitten.
Fingers were all intact, yeah. And nice. Yeah, and you know, when we put a boundary in and sort of we took a sidestep around what he was willing to do with the dog, and that was the garden situation. But I think the dog was just reflective of the situation rather than the dog necessarily being the full issue. But it definitely, I was definitely feeling the fear.
And that's the thing, you know. It can add to the tension. If a dog's barking, if a dog's present, it can ramp up the situation. You know, animals can sense the tension in a situation. If their owner's tense and if their owner's all right, there's been many a time I've been in a situation where a client has become visibly upset at something I've said, or something, as angry at something I've said, and understandably so, dogs have got protective of their owners. And if you're dealing with a dog which has already got form, like that one, it can certainly ramp up tensions, can't it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think on reflection, probably should have thought about doing that home visit as a rule. Like, actually, did we have enough information before we walked into that home visit that actually that wasn't never going to be a conducive visit? And I think those are some of the things you need to think about, because most of the time you have that sort of knowledge that actually, yeah, this dog is already a really aggressive dog, to the point that it's gone through the courts and there's been a public order, you know, and the dog has to be muzzled. And then we're also going in, obviously, with a probation officer into a situation where, you know, me as a social worker of the child of that family, like, actually, we already know before walking in that this is a really tense, aggressive situation. And then the dog was very distracting as you're trying to have this quite difficult conversation, and then the dog's kind of leaping up. And we did move then into the kitchen, but then the kitchen was like an alley kitchen, and then we were kind of backed up like into this alley, like kitchen.
Yes,
And I was like looking at the probation officer, like, oh God, what have we
I feel
done?
cringy here. I feel awkward for you. I'm getting secondhand awkwardness transported from 7 years in the past.
I know.
Wow, I bet you needed a massage after that visit.
Oh, definitely, definitely. We kind of both walked out of the house, kind of looking at each other, being like, wow, what did we just do? What were we just a part of? Was this at all helpful in any situation? No, probably not. And I think that's probably, you know those sorts of things before you go in, and actually, yeah, it should never have happened really on reflection, but it did. And I will never forget the sight of watching a huge dog trying to smash through glass to get to me.
Intense times. I, you
Really
know,
intense.
I've had nothing like that happen to me. I've
We're
had
not as
plenty
stupid
of,
as me, clearly.
I just, no, it's just unlucky in that situation, because ultimately
Yeah.
that's the reality of our job. We've got to go into people's homes. We're
Yeah.
charged to go into people's homes, regardless of what we might find there. Yes, we can try and minimize that risk as much as possible, but if we're supporting children in, you and my line of work in child protection, we have to go and see where they live. We have to see where they sleep. We have to talk to the people that care for them. We've got to go into there regardless. And it's difficult. It's very, very difficult indeed. I've had nothing like that. I've had plenty of people try to sell me kittens, plenty of people trying to sell me puppies. Just today, I was with a family where there was a little chihuahua. Yesterday, I was with a family. I had a very excitable dog, which was a half husky, half Staffordshire Bull Terrier. She was
Wow.
delightful. I came out absolutely covered in hair. I was like wearing the dog when I came out. But no, I've had nothing like that. Thankfully, I'd have nothing like that at all. My approach is to, I'll say, right, let the dog have a good sniff at me. I'll have a good wrestle and a play with the dog for like the first few minutes when I'm introducing myself. And then generally speaking, I find that once a dog knows who you are, once a dog sees you and friendly, it's got your scent, they're usually fine after that. It's usually my approach. Let's talk about this dilemma then, because the reason why we've had these couple of letters come through to the social work supervision section that I do on Fridays is essentially, is it fair to ask clients to take their pets out of the room? Now, obviously, we're not going to say that's best practice. If at all you can avoid it, yes, of course, coexist with the dog. But is it a fair expectation for us to ask our clients to take their pets out of the room? The case you're describing there is kind of an extreme example. But in general, if we simply don't want a dog in the room, is it okay for us to ask dogs to leave, or should we think twice in case that comes across as rude and potentially creating a distance between us and those we are supporting?
Yeah, I was thinking when you were talking earlier about your approach and how you walk into the family home and the things that you were saying. And I think, as with everything in our jobs, there's no hard and fast rule, but ultimately it's a way in which you approach it. If you walk into a family's home and you make demands around how they're living, how you're going to conduct the visit, and that sort of, that awkwardness that you talked about, and trying to make things as comfortable as possible for the people with whom you're working with, I think everything's appropriate. For example, if you've got an allergy, actually being covered head to toe in fur is probably not going to be particularly great for you if you've got an allergy. So asking politely, and even before before you even started the visit, do you have pets? I'm really sorry, I'm allergic. Would it be possible that you could place the dog wherever, or the cat, et cetera, et cetera? Then I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but it's about how you approach it and how you your expectations of how people adapt to you within their own home.
And how would you say to go about doing that? Say if you're working with a client and you don't want to, how do you approach that? How do you broach that subject?
I think I would start with almost like a minor apology, isn't it? Because actually, pets are very much part of people's families. For a lot of people, pets are as much as part of their family as anyone else. So I think, ask, it would be no different if you were to say, oh, could you keep that member of the family in a different room? I don't want to see him. So I just sort of say, I'm really sorry, but I'm a bit fearful of dogs, or you know, I'm allergic to dogs, or I'm not really comfortable about dogs. Is it okay if you know you could place them in a different room, or is that you know, would that be all right just while I'm there? And just trying to, I think, like you said, in most circumstances, if you explain the reason, if you take the responsibility for your feelings and why you find it an issue, then I don't think that most of the time you would have a negative reaction to that. And if you are going to get a negative reaction, then that can help you kind of pace, like understanding what the situation is within the home. But yeah, I think most people, if you're honest and say, "Hi, I'm highly allergic to fur. Would you mind if the dog isn't all over me because it will make me quite sick?" I think most people will adapt, and we have to be mindful that we are walking into someone's home. So if we're asking someone to adapt for that, then we have to take the responsibility of why we feel that way.
Yeah, 100%. The way I would approach it is to make it a request, not a demand. And I think that if you can show vulnerability, as social workers, we need to be inherently aware of the power that we carry within us. Now, quite often as social workers, we can be quite self-deprecating, we can be quite down upon ourselves, we can certainly feel downtrodden. And at times when we think about, we're quite often told no when we're seeking funding in terms of society, we're not always viewed very positively. We can kind of forget that we do hold a lot of power. You know, we are regulated professionals. We have significant power in our sway in terms of the assessments that we write. Now, of course, those are ultimately signed off by courts, but the voices in the courtroom, which tend to have the largest professional sway, are those of social workers, whether they're particularly if you're talking about child protection, whether those be social workers employed by local authorities or social workers employed by Kafka's guardians. Very, very rare if a social worker from the local authority and a social worker from the guardian are on the same page, will the judge overrule both of them and go against them. It's very rare indeed, unless there's an occasion where there's potentially an expert assessment that potentially contradicts those positions. So we carry a lot of power. We carry a lot of power. And if we go into a family home and we start waving our big stick around and our power, that dog has to, can you take that dog out of the room? Or even say, like, can you take that dog out of the room, please? Like, put it in that context. You're a certain power in somebody's home. Now, we know as human beings, when we have a look at our evolutionary biology, we are very territorial. This is the reason why road rage happens, because people are in their cars and see it as an extension of their self. And if a car cuts somebody up, they'll go light. You wouldn't do that in the, if it was just two people walking together down a street, you bumped into somebody, you usually say sorry. But when we're in cars, we become territorial. This is why neighbors end up stabbing each other over disputes over the hedge being about 20 centimeters too high. You know, we become very territorial as human beings. We have that innate need to protect our territory. It's ingrained in us because at one point that was a very deep survival instinct. We had to defend our territory from threats. Those threats aren't really there anymore, but we still perceive that. That feeling is still there within us. And I think you have to respect people's territory. So just really echoing what you've said there, I suppose, Cara, in relation to if you ask it as a request, not a demand, you do it politely and, you know, potentially show a little bit of vulnerability because that helps to bridge a gap with a client. You know, and I always think when I'm working with clients, the most important thing you can do, it goes back to Carl Rogers, person-centered therapy. Rogers described good communication as a bridge between two people. And the key to building that bridge is not to assume the other person's going to meet you halfway. You keep building your bridge towards them in hope, not an expectation that they'll meet you. And a good way to build that bridge is to show a little bit of vulnerability. And that's why I always think when I'm assessing clients, I always put a little bit of my own vulnerability in there. Not anything that's inappropriate, not anything that would affect my professional reputation, not anything that would make the client distant from me or think that's not really unprofessional. Just put a little bit of something there. Like occasionally I'll say, you know, well, I grew up in a single parent family. I grew up in poverty. You know, I've had these experiences, you know, share those things. And I think one of the ways you can do that in this situation is to say, oh, I'm really sorry to say this, but I'm very scared of dogs. I had this bad experience. Share a little bit about that experience. Say, oh, I'm really sorry to say this, but I'm scared of dogs. When I was a child, there was this aggressive dog. It bit me. I was scared. I've been fearful since I was a child. Would you mind taking it out? And not only are you explained to the client in a polite way, but you're also showing a bit of humanity. It doesn't make you any less professional. It doesn't affect the outcome of your work. It's never going to be brought up in court and say, oh, this social worker, you shouldn't listen to their views because they told me they were bit by a dog when they were four. No, it humanizes you and it builds a connection. And I always think if you can show humility, if you can show humanity, if you can show a little bit of tenderness and vulnerability in yourself, it can help clients to open up.
Beautiful. I think you're spot on. And it's that power dynamic, isn't it? And actually allowing, I think sometimes people are scared, social workers are scared to sort of make themselves vulnerable and say, well, I'm a little bit fearful. And actually that, you know, that's a really relatable feeling and most people will understand it. So, yeah, I think it's the perfect way to approach it.
Let's talk about formal risk assessments then. You'll have done a lot more of these than I have. How many times have you done a pet risk assessment as part of a foster or adoption assessment?
The bane of my life. The bane of my life. Yeah, I used to do quite a few in my time of chickens, rats.
How do you risk assess a chicken? What risk in a chicken pose?
I had a foster carer who they used to like knock on the door, the back door, to, you know, and then she used to open the door and they used to pop in and they're great. Who knew chickens were such fun pets, but they are.
And they give you eggs and they feed you as well.
Exactly. And they're really friendly and they call to their names. It's like you learn a lot about different pets when you walk into other people's homes, because that definitely chickens was not something that was on offer for me when I was at home.
Any potential risks? I mean, could you be pecked by a chicken? Could you be clawed by a rooster?
Yeah, and you know, just general hygiene, I think, with chickens generally is the biggest issue. But yeah, no, I approached pet risk assessments like you would any family member. Like I said, a lot of people's pets are their family. Mm. And so if you go in and kind of start making wild judgments and being quite, not showing that vulnerability and understanding and empathizing with their love for their pet, who might not always be the best well-behaved. You know, you can't be overly critical. But I always took it in fostering in the sense that it was my responsibility to the pet and my responsibility to the owner to think about them as much in my risk assessments as I did for any potential child walking through that door. Because the reality is that not all children will know how to be around pets, and that I don't want a family to be in a situation where, you know, the pet has been agitated or upset, and, you know, and children are children and so don't always know the boundary of when an animal has had enough and may, you know, well be placed in a situation where we're then asking them to make a decision about the pet remaining in the home. And so I always approached it in I'm responsible to you as a foster carer and to you as your family, and that includes your pets, and making decisions and supporting them to understand the risks in a way that I want them to be okay and for no incidents to cause these kind of really difficult situations 6 months down the line.
Have you ever had a negative pet risk assessment?
Not to my knowledge. I mean,
I've never known of one.
No, I've had times where we've had dog trainers come in, and I've had situations where, you know, a dog has nipped a child, mainly puppies, really, and had dog trainers come in and that sort of thing. And I've had times where children have, you know, accidentally or for whatever reason, you know, injured a pet or upset a pet. But most of the time, as with anything, you can try and adapt the situation, adapt what's happening, where the dog is, where the pets are. Even with the chickens, it was like the conversation about, okay, well, the chickens can't just come in if you've got, you know, a little child and a chick, you know, four chickens in the house.
Wandering about.
We have to be like, you know, I've had house bunnies, you know, okay, well, the house bunny can't just be, you know, if you've got a toddler. So it's just, as with anything, as with all risk assessments, it's considering the risk and then adapting the behaviour around it, you know, and being a bit flexible to what's happening.
And what would you say is a good approach to a, because I've only done a couple in my career, you've done loads. What's a good approach to those kind of assessments? You know, what would you say would be best practice in undertaking a pet risk assessment?
I always say I'm not an expert, so you know, I'm not a dog behaviorist. So I can only make an assessment on my judgment of knowledge of dogs to what I have and what I'm able to access. So I think, you know, it's those joint conversations with a family about the behavior and the presentation and learning from them, because they will know their pet better than you will. And unless, you know, I've never even owned a dog, so it's kind of, you know, the blind leading the blind sometimes with that sort of thing. But it's about being obvious, isn't it, in terms of what the potential risks are. And I think, yeah, it's just doing that assessment jointly. It's about being open and honest. It's about being open and honest about what the potential risks are, not just in terms of the risks of the dog to exterior factors, but actually what it means when you foster in terms of, you know, a child, children coming into home and what the potential risk could be to that pet as well. So it's about being thoughtful and undertaking it jointly, being open and honest about what the potential hazards, risks are, and I guess ultimately being clear on what the boundaries are, because that is something that could happen, is actually this pet is a risk and that means that you can't foster. I mean, it's very incredibly rare, but that, you know, that could be a factor.
It's hard though, isn't it? Because it's very, very difficult, I find, when you are assessing potential foster carers. I would say potentially more so when you connect assessing potential connected carers who are family members and you've got a definite child in mind to place with them, whether it's a grandchild, a niece, a nephew, a cousin, you know, something like that. Those are generally the connections, because in those situations, you know that if that child isn't going there, they're potentially looking at adoption or long-term foster care, you know, so never having the opportunity to grow up in their birth family. And it can be very, very difficult when you're doing risk assessments in those situations, you know, whether it includes anything like, you know, shared bedrooms, you know, the home conditions, the general connected carers assessment that you do of the family, and then the additional risk assessments, such as the pet assessment, to ask a family, well, okay, you're going to turn your world upside down. You are going to be asked to care for a child. Let's be honest here, Cara. Most of the time, those children have come with significant trauma. There's a reason they have left their parents' care and have to be moved, you know, to an alternative care arrangement, whether that is fostering or adoption, or in this case, we're talking about a connected carers assessment. And it can be hard to say to that family, well, okay, you're going to have to work with professionals. You're going to have to go on this training. You are going to have to support contact. You're going to have to come along to these meetings. You're going to have to care for this child. You're going to have to suddenly start taking them to school again. A lot of the time, these are potentially people who've already raised their older children and thought that the child caring days were kind of been and done. And then, oh, well, by the way, as well, that family pet might be a risk. It stings, doesn't it? It really does sting when you're in that situation, because you know that you're asking these people to take on a lot, and sometimes you potentially ask them to give up a lot of what they've already got as well, too.
Yeah, and I think it's about being realistic, isn't it? Like, all dogs are potentially a risk, whether you're in a fostering home, a connected, you know, any home, a dog is a potential risk. Let's be realistic about it. But also, dogs and pets are such amazing opportunities for children to learn to love and care and respond to love. And you know, a dog's kisses, you know, when you're sad, is something such an amazing opportunity for children. So I think it's like any kind of risk and any kind of assessment that we're doing, it's about being balanced and thinking not just about, oh my goodness, that, you know, a child could be hurt by a dog. Actually, dogs bring all these amazing things. I had a young person had a hamster given to them when they were in residential care, which is an absolute no-no, giving children pets in residential care, but they did that anyway. And this hamster was revolutionary to this child's life. Like, they processed a lot of their trauma through their care of this hamster. You know, think about, well, I'm going to be away for 2 days, so who's going to look after the hamster? You can't just leave, you know, the hamster on its own. What happens if? And it was, they were processing all this big stuff through the care and you know, parenting of their hamster, and it was amazing to watch. And I just think pets bring that to children, and losing a pet when you move from your family home into another family is devastating. And I don't think we give enough thought about what it means for children to leave their family pets as well as their, you know, their family. And I just think that you have to be sort of a bit pragmatic around your approach to it. And, you know, all life has risks. All dogs could be risky. All cats could be, you know, rats and chickens could be risky, but they bring such amazing things alongside that.
What you said there just struck a chord. It reminded me of a dormant memory from many years ago. I was working with a family of four. The mum had significant issues, significant mental health issues, victim of domestic abuse and subsequent relationships. She was eventually involved in drug and alcohol use to a quite a significant level as well. Just, Taylor's oldest time in an effort to kind of block out the trauma that she was experiencing. Four children by four different fathers. The younger three initially ended up with family members. The oldest child who'd seen the worst, surprise, surprise, his behavior was somewhat difficult. His behavior was so difficult that he wasn't able to be placed locally and ended up being placed around 100 miles away in a residential home that was kind of really on the cusp of secure. That's the kind of level that we're talking about. And it was just so tragic because it was just so obvious where this young boy's behavior came from. And we worked with him. He was doing better. He eventually learned to say learned. He was supported to regulate. He'd never been taught how to regulate his emotions. How could you? There, but for a grace of God, go the rest of us. If we'd have grown up in that household, we would have been the same, if not worse. He was very resilient given what he'd gone through. The point I make is the one thing he wanted more than anything, whenever you did his wishes and feelings, whenever you asked what you want, he would always ask about the family dog. He would always ask about the family dog. And it turned out that the dog had been sold. It was suspected it was sold in order to fund a drug debt. And it was very, very difficult times about whether to share that news with him or not. So yes, it was almost as if the dog was kind of his North Star. If the dog was okay and if mum was looking after the dog, it was almost as if, well, I think when things were going well, the dog was well looked after, was kind of the vibe. So yeah, that was a, I don't know whether it was a bigger loss to him than his mother and siblings. You certainly can't say that, but it was the one that he spoke about and felt most comfortable speaking about. It was almost if he projected everything onto that dog, and it was a harrowing time having to discuss whether we shared that news with him, because it was almost as if the hope that he would see the dog was kind of the excitement that he was holding on to. So yes, I've seen that myself, and yeah, I totally forgot about that. Let me just come back there. Let's end on this one then, because you spoke a little about there, and it's come to mind in relation to how that child looked after a hamster. Can you read anything into people by how they care for their pets?
I think so, yes. It's like parenting, though, isn't it? Because there's no, there's a lot of things which verge on what's right and what's not right in parenting. And I think caring for animals, you can equally kind of tread that difficult scope of what is okay, what isn't, what's an approach that you might want to take, what isn't. But I think general care and love for a pet, I think, shows that level of empathy, that level of understanding, that level of responsibility. Like you said there, that, you know, depending on how a family is doing, sometimes can be whether or not there is enough finances to feed the dog a certain way. You know, if people are struggling with their capacity, how often that dog's getting walked, how often they're being let out to use the toilet, all those sorts of things. I think that's a massive insight. And I think, you know, one of the things that you always hear around really neglectful homes is walking in and there being a lot of pet excrement and, you know, kind of people not being able to keep on top of the basic care of a pet. And I think that does reflect on in care in general and where people are at. But I think there's a scope to it, and there's an understanding that there are some things that are okay and not okay that are just general approaches to pet care, which are very Very dependent on your on how you view, caring for
Yeah.
dogs or pets or in general.
Well, there's a correlation, isn't there, between harm to animals and harm to people. There's
Sure.
a direct correlation. Generally speaking, if people have got the ability to hurt an animal, that can be an indicator that they would hurt other humans because it's kind of breaking a taboo, isn't it? Particularly if you think of animals, animals are dependent. Obviously, children are as well, and many adults end up so vulnerable and dependent upon abusive people in their lives too. But animals don't have the voice. Obviously, children at a certain age then become a voice. They have an ability to explain what's happening. Animals can never do that. And I agree with you that they're not always, of course. It's always the case. You always have to say not always because there'll be someone who will listen to go on this. Well, I once knew a case where the dogs were treated well, or vice versa. Yes, of course, there are always outliers, but you can't cover any single possibility when you're having these discussions. But I like you, genuinely do believe that there is a general theme of animal neglect and animal abuse towards human neglect and human abuse. And there are many, many studies. There is a direct correlation when you look at extreme behaviors, psychopathic behaviors, murderous behaviors, particularly torturous behaviors. There was a direct link between people hurting animals and people hurting humans. So whilst I don't think you can read everything into it, I certainly think it could be a good tool tied to your assessment toolkit, can it not?
Absolutely. And like you say, there's research that backs up and evidences that that thinking a lot of in a, and a lot of different behaviors towards pets and how that is
Yeah.
kind of instrumental around kind of what else has played out within family homes. So yeah, I think it's just something to be mindful of, isn't it? If you walk into a home, you're observing everything. And actually, I think pets and like you say, those they're the quite, the ones that can't speak. And actually, if you treat something very vulnerable in a really negative way, that gives you a lot of insight into, what else is going on in the home. So yeah, I think it's really helpful as an assessment tool.
Can you read anything into the quality of a social worker by how much mango he eats?
I mean, I don't know if we've got time to do the
Oh,
psychoanalytical
no. Let's not go down that route
a
again.
deep research paper onto you. I'm sure there's probably someone out there that started
Oh, I can see the white coats now. Right,
Yeah.
listeners. On that note, thank you ever so much for tuning in. As always, head over to mysocialrentnews.com, check out the articles we've been discussing. You can also find us on social media, whatever channel that takes your fancy, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. We'll be back next week. Until then, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.